This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we again mark the anniversary of the Armenian Genocide of 1915 at the hands of the Ottoman Turks.
We will hear a portion of the Law and Disorder documentary on the Armenian Genocide.
We also speak with scholar Bedros Dermatosyan on his new book, The Horrors of Adana, Revolution and Violence in the Early 20th Century.
In this interview, we learned of the twin massacres leading up to the Armenian Genocide.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Around the world, April 24th marks the observance of the Armenian Genocide. On that day in 1915, the Interior Minister of the Ottoman Empire ordered the arrest and hangings of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople. The date is widely considered to be the original beginning of a systematic and well-documented plan to eliminate the Armenians, who had been under Ottoman rule and treated as second-class citizens since the 15th century. The unspeakable and gruesome nature of the killings, beheadings of groups of babies, dismemberments, mass burnings, mass drownings, use of toxic gas, lethal injections, render oral histories particularly difficult. Why did this happen? Despite being deemed inferior to Turkish Muslims, the Armenian community had attained a prestigious position in the Ottoman Empire, and the central authorities there grew apprehensive of their power and their longing for a homeland. A concerted plan of deportation and extermination was allowed to be carried out, in large part, because World War I demanded the involvement and concern of potential allied countries. As the writer Grigoris Balakian wrote, the war provided the Turkish government, quote, their sole opportunity, one unprecedented, to exploit the chaos of war in order to effect their extermination plan. As Armenians escaped to several countries, including the United States, a number came to New Britain, Connecticut in 1892 to work in the factories of what was then known as the hardware capital of the world. By 1940, nearly 3,000 Armenians lived there in a tight-knit community.
"95 years has gone by, and they still have not acknowledged that this happened, and it was a genocide.
As a nation, how can they deny this? I mean, how can it be denied? It's a half of a population was removed."
"I don't like Turks per se because of what they did to our people, but I do enjoy the culture.
Why would I grow up hating the Turks if she didn't tell us stories? Well, then we must have been told something that we hated the Turks."
Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
"Yeah, I think they were threatened by the culture. And the genocide started 1915, April 24, in Istanbul, where they took all the intelligentsia of the country and took them outside of the city and hanged them."
The overlay was, of course, religious, with Muslims, and they're the first country to acknowledge Christianity as a national religion. So, you know, there's a lot of history here with all of that.
"The other thing that the Turks used to say, where is your Jesus now? Where is he? Why isn't he saving you?"
Well,
they would say
funny,
this on the death marches.
My brother Ernest was killed in an automobile accident. And his uncle came over to my house and said, "Hey, Ostian, where is your God now?" And she cupped her ears and she said, "Chilasim, Chilasim, I don't want to hear that. God gave him to me and God took him away." how much more Christian could you be?
As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors who continue to live in New Britain, Connecticut, a shared history, a shared identity emerges. Some learned about the massacres directly from their parents or family members, while others were not told at all. Often, surviving women were ashamed to talk about what they had experienced, because so many of them had been raped or forced into harems. For others, conjuring up visual images of the atrocities was too painful to bear. When parents did speak about the crimes they experienced or witnessed, they frequently spoke in Turkish or Assyrian instead of English or Armenian, so that their children couldn't understand. Most children of survivors say that the subject was a secret, even forbidden.
My mother did not keep secrets from us. She spoke about the Turks. She hated the Turks. She made us hate the Turks. I remember as a teenager, I wanted to send away for Turhan Bey's picture in Hollywood, and he was a very handsome Turkish actor. We weren't allowed anyway. But the ones who did keep it secret were the ones who were ashamed of what happened. And I know for a fact many of the older women, older than my mother, had gotten raped. Those are the ones, in my opinion, in this area, were the ones who kept it secret.
I grew up hearing, like the others, my mother didn't talk about it to me, ever. But I was a little girl, and my mother was quite a bit older than I was. She was older when I was born. And so her friends would come over, and they would sit and talk to each other. The next thing you know, they'd all start crying. And I would cry, too. And my mother would turn to me and say, "Why are you crying?" And I'd say, "Because you're crying," and not knowing why I was crying.
And just recently, we found out that this one got raped, that one got raped, and this is why they couldn't talk about it. Now, I don't know about the men, why the men kept it secret. But as far as the women, yes, you're right, the men were too young. But many of the women did get raped. And those are the ones, in my opinion, that really kept it a secret. And my mother told me many stories. So she wasn't ashamed. She didn't have that feeling of being ashamed.
In our house, it was a secret. And then you hear someone would be talking about something, and then as you approach, they say Biji Oğlan, which means little boy, that's me, and everything would switch into Turkish, and everybody, and then, you know, some Armenians would come visit from Whitensville, and they'd sit in the living room, they're all talking Turkish. It was a forbidden thing to discuss.
I had heard these stories. As I listened, I really heard these stories. And then the old country. They always talked about the old country. And I had no idea where it was. When I was a little girl, I thought the old country was like Tallinn, Connecticut. And I just had no idea. But I always wanted to go there. And then I felt terrible because I never had a grandmother or a grandfather or an aunt, a real aunt or an uncle.
As children growing up, you know, friends would come to the house. Now, they would always speak Armenian, but whenever they had an off-color story to tell, and you could always tell it was an off-color story because the way they broke into laughter, it was always told in Turkish or Assyrian. And then they'd revert back to English. So the stories were really not designed for children to hear. It was for them. But you could always tell by their laughter that something was going on, you know, that they didn't want us to know about. And in point of fact, that's what they always did. If there was something going on at the dinner table, and they didn't want us to know what was going on, they'd speak Assyrian or Turkish to one another. So that whole business of speaking Turkish and the residual effects of the genocide were interesting, kind of almost juxtaposed one against the other.
Genocide has both physical and non-physical aspects, destroying the national culture of the oppressed group and imposing that of the oppressor. That was the theory of legal scholar Raphael Lemkin, who coined the word genocide in 1943 with the Turkish extermination of the Armenians in mind. While genocide is defined as the organized destruction, in whole or in part, of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group, Lemkin wrote that a group need not be only physically exterminated to suffer genocide. Erasing a people's cultural identity through destruction of their language, religion, social, and political institutions, that too is genocide. The Armenian Genocide, the very first of the 20th century, may be viewed in four distinct segments. The first segment began with the deportation and killing of the 250 intellectuals. Before that, in 1895, Ottoman suspicion of the Armenian population had led to the massacre of 300,000 Armenians by a special order of the government. In 1909, 30,000 more were slaughtered. The second segment involved the conscription of approximately 60,000 Armenian men into the General Turkish Army. They were later disarmed and killed by their Turkish counterparts. The third segment comprised of massacres, deportations, and death marches of women, children, and the elderly into the Syrian deserts. Hundreds of thousands were killed by Turkish soldiers, gendarmes, and Kurdish mobs. Others perished from famine, epidemic diseases, and exposure to the elements. Thousands of women and children were raped. Tens of thousands were forcibly converted to Islam. The final segment of the genocide is still ongoing and consists of the denial by the Turkish and United States governments that a genocide even occurred. Despite the body of documentation that exists, Turkey has launched a well-orchestrated and financed campaign of denial through inaccurate scholarship, propaganda, and extensive lobbying. Turkey even has a law which forbids mention of the word genocide.
Article 301 in Turkey essentially makes genocide an illegal word to use, a term. It's a denial. If you don't have the word, it doesn't exist. Genocide didn't exist. And so what you're doing is, in essence, is saying, if we don't recognize the word, if we don't use the word, then all mention, all concept of a genocide disappears. So what can you call it? Massacres? The first Holocaust? I mean, there are a lot of ways you can define it. They've chosen because it's genocide, and it truly was genocide. The issues are deep-seated. The conflicts were deep-seated. It's not only religious. It was control. It was economic. It was financial. Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
Arthur Shevardian's father was orphaned and came to New Britain from what is today Iran, but that was in 1915 a part of the Ottoman Empire. Arthur teaches a component on the Armenian genocide for a local high school's course on the subject of genocide.
My father is Ashot Dmitri Shavardian, and that's the Armenian pronunciation, Shavardian, and my mother, Rose. The material for this particular conversation began several years ago at the request of a teacher at Avon High School who has a course called Genocide, Holocaust and Genocide. And he asked if I could come and share my family's story of the genocide with the students at Avon High School, their juniors and seniors. It really forced me to go back and do some reconstruction. We had bits and pieces, but had never really put the story together in any format. So I went back and found some documentation that my father had kept. I did some research, historical research as well. A lot of what we have is factual information because I have the original documentation. Some of it is put together from hearsay and then trying to create a story. And in those pieces that we don't know that I've created, I hope 2 + 2 becomes 4 and not 5. But it's close. It's close to the story. And the story begins, my father was born in 1903. He always said he was born in 1905. But when we look through the original documentation, it turns out he was baptized in 1903. So therefore, he couldn't have been born in 1905. Likely, it had to do with presenting himself as a younger person to be able to latch on to another member of the family to come to the United States as part of the visa process.
As a second-generation Armenian, I too have pieced together the fragments of stories from my family. My grandfather was a medical student at a college in Carpet. He said he had to beg his older sister for the tuition, and when he walked down the street, people would point to him with awe as the person who was going to college. When the genocide started, he enlisted or was drafted into the army. He narrowly and with difficulty escaped and came to the United States. I don't know how, but he was proud of the fact that he didn't have to disguise himself as a woman, as other men did, in order to beg or borrow his way out of the country. Then, in 1918, when Armenia was granted independence, he went back. He said the persecutions not only still existed, but that they were worse than before, so the process of escaping was even more difficult the second time. Coming to this country with no language or professional skills, he got a job in the foundry. In a short time, a flying piece of hot metal burned out one eye. The genocide ruined his life in Armenia and also in the United States. He had sent to the orphanage in Greece for a wife. The Armenian Relief Society paid for sending my grandmother to the United States. But when she got to Ellis Island, they wouldn't let her off the ship because of a gray halo around the iris of one eye. Again, the Relief Society paid to send her to Cuba because entry from there was less stringent. They found her a family to stay with, 9 people in a one-room house with a dirt floor. They took her daily to a clinic for a nurse to put eye drops in her eye. After 6 months, the nurse told the doctor that there was no change, so she must not have had an active, dangerous condition. The doctor agreed. Now it was better for her to enter through Mexico. Her daughter, my aunt, helped tell this story and says how impressed she always was with the kindness of strangers throughout the process. Historic Armenia was located along the Mediterranean Sea, in what exists today as Turkey. It's also, according to the Book of Genesis, where Noah's Ark came to rest, the first nation to adopt Christianity in AD 301. Armenians lived for centuries in their own kingdoms until the Ottoman invasions in the 1200s, when they became second-class citizens. After World War I, the Independent Republic of Armenia existed for just 2 years, from 1918 to 1920, in a fragment of what had once been their homeland. While Armenians had been attacked often prior to the massacre of 1895, the later 1915 genocide had the specific goal of eradicating all traces of the ancient nation. With the outbreak of World War I, the Young Turk government wanted to save what remained of the weakened Ottoman Empire. It adopted a policy of pan-Turkism, the establishment of a vast Turkish empire comprised of all Turkish-speaking peoples of the Caucasus and Central Asia extending to China. The goal included the Turkification of all ethnic minorities of the empire. The Armenian population became the main obstacle toward realization of this policy. Although the decision to deport all Armenians from eastern Turkey had been adopted in late 1911, the Young Turks intentionally used World War I as a pretext for its implementation. Of the 3 million Armenians living in Turkey at that time, more than 1.5 million endured unimaginable atrocities, were slaughtered, raped, or forced into Muslim harems. Churches, which formed the religious and cultural backbone of their lives, were destroyed, while homes were burned, property confiscated, and families killed and separated forever. Lucy and Roxy, Araxi, Maljanian, and Mary Abrahamian are sisters. Together they recount their mother's story.
My name is Roxy Yesyan Maljanian. My mother came from the village of Ichme in Harput, Armenia, Turkey now, and I'm one of 3 sisters that are here present representing our family. And the family name was Pilibozhin. Kuyumjan was the deep name. And our mother was born in 1908. And she came here to America after the genocide. And as a little girl, she remembers quite a few things about 1915. And when my mother was in her late 60s, early 70s, she started writing her history in Armenian. And she wrote it in very colloquial Armenian. She was an Armenian school teacher here in New Britain, taught students after she got married and came here. And in her story, since it was in Armenian, my sisters and I translated it after her death. She wrote it in the last years of her life. And she remembered many things of her childhood. And we divided the story into three sections. And each sister took a third of it to translate it the best we can. We all read Armenian. Like I said, she did it simply so we can understand it. We knew some of the stories. She talked about them, her childhood in the orphanage. And she tells us the nice things, really, about the orphanage. As children, she was 7 years old until she was 18. She was in the orphanage. She remembers the groups of children who were all just like her. They had lots of fun because they were children, and they played games and sports, and they learned crafts in the orphanage. The German Protestant orphanage taught them crafts, handiwork. So they learned many things, reading and writing. So they were happy as much as possible because everybody was in the same situation. And she remained there until 18. And at 18, there were newspapers here in America looking for orphans in different orphanages. And if your name appeared on a list, the orphan director would send a letter to the person in America that we have this child in this orphanage. And they would write to the orphan, and the orphan would identify herself or himself. And in that way, they were able to get to America through a relative that was here. That's one way that people got home. But at 18, you had to leave the orphanage. When she was 7, 1908 to 1915, she was 7 years old. Before she got to the orphanage, she remembers as a little girl, the Turkish people in the villages were all their neighbors, and they got along very good with their neighbors, and they had fun with them because they were all in the same community. Even though the majority in this village was Armenian, they had Turkish people living there too. The trouble started, the rumors start coming into the villages that things were happening, and their children. She was warned that if something happened, you know, you go with your aunts and uncles. Her mother had died when she was a child, and she was living with aunts in the village. And her father was already in America, so they lived with the aunts. The first one of the incidents she writes and talked about was she remembered the gathering of the men in the village. And the village of Ichmet, the houses were low roof, and you can go on your roof and look at what's happening. And the church was right below the street that they lived on. And my sisters and I both, all three of us, have visited Ichmet. And we took two trips to Ichmet so we can kind of visualize what happened. The church was on the street below, and they remember the men being gathered and taken into that church and hollering, and they heard the screams. And the next thing, the church was being burned, and they remember the church being burned and screaming and the hollering of all the people dying in this building. And then she recalled going from house to house. They were starting to hide from things. And you can run on the rooftops in Ichmet. They were flat roofs, close to each other. And you could jump, and you're 7, 8 years old. You jump from building to building. And they were able to jump to the next building and hide in the neighbor's house. So now they knew there was trouble. So you could go down to the next house and hide somehow. She remembered that. And then when the time came and they were coming into the village and they'd see more, maybe my sister Lucy can relate that part of the village. Do you remember them, the hiding, what the uncle told them to do?
When they came into the homes, they all had to gather whatever belongings they had to start the march. They told my mother, we're going to hide our gold. It's going to be in this chest and come in the back, and we're going to hide it in the ground, but you never, ever tell anybody where it is. So all their gold coins and jewelry, they hid in the backyard, courtyard, wherever it was, and then they gathered them up and they started this horrific march.
The Armenian identity is now a collective one, pieced together from historical documents and personal stories handed down from survivors to their children. The media did cover the events as they happened, and the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau, told the Secretary of State in July 1915 that, quote, a campaign of race extermination is in progress, under a pretext of reprisal against rebellion. On May 6, 1915, the New York Times reported that, quote, the Young Turks have adopted the policy of Sultan Abdulhamid, namely, the annihilation of the Armenians. That was an excerpt from the 90-minute special, It Was Genocide, Armenian Survivor Stories. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In 1909, a few years before the 1914 Ottoman genocide of the Armenians, two massacres killed more than 20,000 Christians, most of whom were Armenian. The attacks transpired in Adana, situated on the Mediterranean coast of southern Anatolia. After images show unprecedented destruction of a formerly prosperous city. Armenian churches, businesses, and homes were destroyed, and the violence quickly spread across the province and extended outside its eastern borders into the province of Aleppo. Despite the magnitude of these devastating atrocities, no one was held accountable. In fact, the attacks have remained largely absent from the history books. But that's about to change. Bedros Dermatosyan has written a meticulously researched examination of these two events. It's called The Horrors of Adana, Revolution and Violence in the Early 20th Century, published by Stanford University Press. It's a detailed exploration of the twin massacres and the events and economic and sociopolitical transformations that led up to them. Today, we're delighted to speak with Bedros Dermatosyan. He's associate professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and also president of the Society for Armenian Studies. He's author and co-editor of several books, including the award-winning Shattered Dreams of Revolution, From Liberty to Violence in the Late Ottoman Empire. Bedros, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi and Jim, for inviting me to your excellent show. It's an honor to be on Law and Disorder.
Let's start with the definition. How do you define the word massacre?
Of course, massacre as a term was used in the 19th century by European governments and elites to indicate, and I quote here Davide Rodogno, the loss of innocent human lives on a vast scale caused by a deliberate act. This was in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. But the massacre as a phenomenon in itself is so complex that it requires a multidisciplinary examination, not only from the standpoint of a historian, but also sociologists, psychologists, political scientists, and anthropologists, and so on. But for my own work, I used the definition by social scientists Philip Dwyer and Lyndon Ryan, according to whom massacres are, and I quote, the killing by one group of a people by another group of people, regardless of whether the victims are armed or not, regardless of age or sex, race, religion, and language, and regardless of political, culture, racial, religions, or economic motives for the killing. The killing can be either driven by official state policy or can occur as a result of states' lack of control over those groups or collectives on the ground. And I think it is important here to distinguish between massacres and genocides. While genocide aims at eliminating a communal group from social structure, massacre seeks to change the behavior of the targeted group through intimidation, as we see in the case of the Hamidian massacres of Armenians 1894-96 and the Adana massacres.
I wonder, Bedros, is there a distinction that is important to make, and if so, please make it for us, between those massacres that are merely brutal and inhumane in the extreme, and those that also are political massacres? How would you define political massacres in this sense?
First, we should distinguish between political massacre from a criminal or pathological mass killings done by or perpetrated by non-political bodies for private ends, all right? So massacres could be non-political bodies, but political massacres include the state and its agencies, but also non-state actors such as factions, paramilitary organizations, parties, terrorist bands, fragments of classes such as laborers and communal groups and so on. So it can be organized by local actors, local government agencies, but also central ones.
Let's turn now to your wonderful book, and we'd both like to congratulate you on this contribution to Armenian history. Can you give our listeners a short summary of what transpired in the Adana massacres? What prompted them, and why so little has been written about them?
Thank you very much, Heidi. The book is based on 15 archives and 12 languages. Its aim is to understand and interpret the massacres of Adana, which took place in April of 1909. The massacres took place on two ways. The first one took place in April 14 to 16, and the second one took place in April 25 to 27. So the reason as to why the massacres of Adana hasn't been highlighted or researched that much, it is because the major concentration has been on the Armenian genocide and earlier phases of violence inflicted upon the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire has not been studied thoroughly. The Adana massacres do not appear in books in Middle Eastern studies or in Ottoman history, and that's why I wanted to write a book in order to demonstrate the complexity of the Adana massacres. It's a complex event that has it's a multifaceted event that has multiple factors playing a role, socioeconomic, political, and other aspects. So the most important factors, I argue, in the book leading to the Adana massacres were the Young Turk Revolution of 1908, which shook the foundations of the fragile equilibrium that had existed in the empire for decades, the emergence of a resilient public sphere after three decades of despotic rule, in which the public sphere was largely repressed, and the counter-revolution of April 1909. So by analyzing the changes in the socio-political, religious, and economic structure in the region, my book provides multi-causal and multifaceted explanation for the events that unfolded in Adana. And I do this through analyzing the event through four interrelated themes: public and subaltern public spheres, rumors, which play an important role in all massacres, actually, emotions, and finally humanitarianism and humanitarian intervention.
What argument or narrative do genocide deniers put forth about the two massacres of Adana? That is to say, what kind of language do they employ?
Of course, perpetrators or governments in general do not depict such events as massacres. They depict it as riots, disturbances, in order to put the blame on the victim. So every time we have such massacres, even in the case of the Odessa massacre, in the case of the Sikh massacre of 1894, the blame is put on the victim itself. And it's and the government has the power to define the event as massacres. In the case of the Adana massacre, the allegation or the allegation is clear. The government says that it was a failed Armenian uprising to establish the Kingdom of Cilicia. So again, 20,000 people were massacred because due to the fact that the kingdom was going to be established and Armenians wanted an independence. Of course, I prove this and I approve it in the book that this is a fallacy and it aims only to serve the government's interpretation. The same allegations that were made at the time during the massacres are still continuing today within the Turkish denialist historiography.
Bedros, can you please describe the difference between cultural and political nationalism? And have both of these equally provoked colonial powers against indigenous ethnicities throughout history?
Yeah, cultural nationalism generally refers to ideas and practices that relate to the intended revival of a national community's culture, whereas political nationalism is focused on the achievement of political autonomy. Cultural nationalism concentrates on the cultivation of national culture. Cultural nationalism sets out to provide a vision of the nation's identity, the past, and destiny. The key agents of cultural nationalism are intellectuals and artists. And cultural nationalism mostly happens during political upheavals, such as in post-revolution. In my case, for example, in the Adana massacre's case, the cultural nationalism immediately erupts after the revolution in the Ottoman Empire, but specifically in Adana, where it manifests in theatrical presentations, poetry, odes, publications, romanticization of Adana's past, symbols, coats of arms, flags of the Cilician kingdom. And all of this, as a matter of fact, gives the impression to the masses in Adana, to the Muslim masses, that Armenians are initiating the steps for political nationalism and irredentism. In the case of colonial toleration, we know that colonial powers actually did, to a certain extent, tolerate cultural nationalism. But when there were hints of political nationalism, they did their best in order to suppress such manifestations, even through violence and repression. And one thing we know, that the type of nationalism that emerged under colonial setting was anti-colonial nationalism. That was the common thread between the old types of nationalism that emerged under colonial powers.
What would you say is the significance of the Adana massacres in relation, though, to the much more well-known Armenian genocide that occurred, well, just a few years later?
Yeah, I mean, the Armenian genocide perpetrated by the inner clique of the CUP during World War I, as The Armenian Genocide, as you know, which was perpetrated by the inner clique of the Committee of Union and Progress during World War I, led to the extermination of Armenians of the eastern provinces. Unlike the counter-revolution of 1909, which was a crisis that led to the Adana massacres, the crisis of World War I unleashed an orchestrated genocide. While massacres of Adana, which were locally organized and implemented by different interest groups, the Armenian genocide was centrally planned by the state through multiple mechanisms. The bureaucratic apparatus and the cooperation of local elites as well as paramilitary organizations proved crucial in coordinating and implementing the genocide in different regions of the eastern provinces. In the case of the Adana massacres, the perpetrators, unlike the Committee of Union Progress during the genocide, were not motivated by a grandiose detrimental ideology of solving once and for all the Armenian question. On the contrary, in 1909, the Young Turks themselves were on the verge of collapse as a result of the counter-revolution and were saved only by the Second Army.
I'm curious, was there any humanitarian intervention either during or after the Adana massacres?
Of course, the concept of humanitarian intervention, we hear it a lot today in the case of Ukraine. The case of Adana massacres, as a matter of fact, demonstrates the limitation of humanitarian intervention on behalf of the Armenians of the empire, as it happened in the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Rodogno, a historian, for example, defines humanitarian intervention as, and I quote, a coercive, diplomatic, and or armed reaction against massacre undertaken by a state or a group of states inside the territory of a target state. Its main motivation is to end massacre, atrocity, and extermination, or to prevent the repetition of such events. So this means that it is an ex post facto event whose objective is to protect civilian population mistreated and unprotected by the target state government agent and authorities. And today, this raises an important question about the authority or responsibility of foreign governments in interfering in the internal affairs of other states. However, in this humanitarian intervention in the 19th century was selective. I say selective because in some cases, for example, such as Greece, Lebanon, and Crete, European intervention did take place in order to stop massacres or in the ex post facto after the massacres. In other cases, such as the Armenian massacres, there was no such humanitarian intervention. So the question rises here as to why intervention did not take place. Scholars argue that if the intervention threatened to disrupt the international power equilibrium, the European powers would not intervene to end massacres. This is similar to today's case in Ukraine. As a matter of fact, you see the massacres of Bucha that took place a few weeks ago, and there wasn't an international humanitarian intervention due to the fact that such intervention would lead to a global conflict, as you know. So, despite the fact that there was no humanitarian intervention in the case of the Adana massacres, there was extensive network of local, regional, and international humanitarian effort to alleviate the suffering of the Armenians of Adana and also help aid the victims of the massacres.
You compare the Adana massacres to the Odessa pogroms of 1871. Since one case had to do with mass murder of 20 to 30,000 indigenous Armenians, and the other with 400 non-indigenous Jews, I wonder, can you discuss how those incidents in your mind were similar and also different?
It was actually the Odessa pogroms of 1905. I do compare it to two other massacres in the book in order to understand the commonalities and the differences between massacres. The other massacre is the Sikh massacre of 1894. Odessa, which is today in the news in Ukraine, a port city on the Black Sea, was similar to Adana in possessing a multi-ethnic population, which composed of Greeks, Jews, Italians, Russians, and Ukrainians, among others. So in 1905, in the period between October 18 and 22, ethnic Ukrainians, Russians, and Greeks killed over 400 Jews and damaged or destroyed over 1,600 Jewish properties. Massacres does not mean that it has to be in the thousands to be called massacres. It could be a couple of hundred to 20,000. Economic competition between the Jews and the Greek, as well as religious frictions, played an important role in the pogroms. Like the Adana massacres, the Odessa pogroms resulted from a host of factors, which here included economic competition, the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, the Russian Revolution of 1905, the October Manifesto, and anti-Semitism. However, a contributing factor in the growth of anti-Semitism was the economic advancement of the Jews in the city. So in the aftermath of these massacres, there was inquiry, government inquiry, to investigate the reasons of the massacre. This was led by the senator Alexander Kuzminsky, and his report, like many government officials, believed that the Odessa pogroms was a spontaneous display of outrage against the Jews, whose political activity had elicited the pogromist response. This is extremely problematic, and we see this happening in post-massacre investigation inquiry commissions. This mischievous reasoning of blaming the victims for their suffering is not novelty in the pages of Russian history, nor a novelty in the case of the Ottoman history. So the details of the Odessa pogrom resemble those of Adana massacres in many respects. First, the events that triggered both massacres were not inherently ethno-religious in nature, but the violence soon assumed an ethno-religious attire due to the underlying socio-economic and political anxieties within the region. Second, in both cases, competition over resources was a significant factor in motivating the behavior of the perpetrator. Third, the ways in which the Kuzminsky report blamed the victims for their own misfortune resembles the conclusion of the Adana investigation reports, the preliminary investigation reports, but with one major difference. After months of deliberations in the Ottoman Empire and lobbying by the Armenian group and the efforts of the Armenian members of the parliament, Hagop Babigyan, the Ottoman government released a statement exonerating the Armenians of the events of Adana. Such exoneration did not transpire with regard to the Jews of Adana.
You know, global attention now, of course, is focused on the atrocities Russia is committing against the people of Ukraine. I wonder, what lessons can we learn from the Adana massacres, and more importantly, have we learned some lessons from that?
I don't think we've learned any lesson from the past, and we say never again, but human societies keep repeating the same violence, same massacres and genocide. Similar to the case of Adana, for example, we don't see humanitarian intervention taking place from the U.S. and Europe. They're only confined to humanitarian aid and supplying of weapons. The other important thing that these massacres, such as the massacres in Bucha, are taking place in front of the eyes of the international media. We have proofs and we have evidences that such crimes against humanities have been perpetrated, but no one is doing anything. So my concern is that the crimes of humanities that have been perpetrated in Ukraine would fall into the same pages in the history in the future, where we were going to study them and then lament as to why no one has interfered. The lessons that we've learned also is that when the international system power equilibrium is so complex that it prevents the intervention of international powers, specifically when the perpetrator, to that extent, the Russia and its invasion of Ukraine, is a powerful entity. I mean, think of it. Everyone rushed immediately to invade Iraq, the first desert storm, because Iraq was weak. But no one dares to do so in the case of Ukraine, because your adversary is a very powerful country. And doing so, and a nuclear power, and doing so might have serious repercussions. And so this is a dilemma to that extent. You know, it's a political dilemma. And the only way that the international community is dealing with it is through drastic measures such as sanctions and providing aid, humanitarian aid, and weapons to the Ukrainians. But there is no humanitarian intervention. There is a lot of justification of intervention. When the country is strong and is a nuclear power, there is no there is reluctance of intervention, of humanitarian intervention, and there is only they're only confined to sanctions, humanitarian aid, and supplying of weapons.
Unfortunately, we're running out of our allocated time. How can our listeners follow your work?
The book and other books of mine are available on Amazon, on the website. You can follow me on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and most importantly on academia.edu, where all my works are present there in terms of articles and books.
Bedros, thank you so much. As we mark the anniversary, of course, of the Armenian genocide, it's really been an honor to have you with us.
Yes, I too thank you, Bedros. I've learned a great deal just from our interview of you today, so I thank you.
Thank you, Heidi, and thank you, Jim.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Destroy. People hear us. soldiers' sweet romance and the soldiers who are dead and gone. If only we could bring back one, he'd say we gotta have peace. Ah, we got to have peace. Let the world know it. Peace, peace, peace. Ah, we got to have peace. People hear us. Through our voice, the world knows there's no choice. Save the children. Save the children. Sweet romance and the soldiers who are there.